This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Attacks between Israel and Gaza show no sign of letting up. Many are looking again to Washington to stop the fighting.
You know, there's an instinct in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the U.S. to roll in and bump everybody out of the way and say, we're in charge, we're going to solve this now. And that is just not the way to solve this conflict.
The world isn't only looking to the U.S. for help calming down the Middle East. Those involved with global health want Washington to lead on the pandemic, too.
What the U.S. does and doesn't do, a lot of countries will take the cue here. So all eyes are on the U.S.
Also today, the CDC says it's okay to take off our masks if we're vaccinated. That guidance is a concern in many immigrant communities where vaccination rates are lower.
The pandemic is not over. The virus is still out there, you know, and workers need to be protected.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. International diplomats are raising their voices, calling for a halt in the fighting between Israel and Gaza. But the government of Israel and the militant group Hamas are unwilling to back down. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken today.
We are working tirelessly across every diplomatic channel we have to advance the prospect of getting to calm and ending the violence.
Blinken also suggested that it's not up to Washington.
It is up to the parties to make clear that they want to pursue a ceasefire. Any ceasefire would be, by definition, between them, but we're ready to engage to support it.
So what exactly is the U.S. role in the Middle East crisis right now, and what can the White House actually do? For that, we turn to Ilan Goldenberg. He served as chief of staff to the U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations during the Obama administration. He now directs the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security.
What Biden has decided to do for the moment is privately tell the Israelis to stop, or to stop soon, while publicly continuing to support them. This helps him build political support inside of Israel. It also gives them leverage for the future. But when there does come a moment, hopefully soon, if it hasn't happened already privately, where Biden says, okay, enough is enough. You must stop, or our public position is going to start to shift. Our position at the UN Security Council, where we've been defending you, is going to start to shift. You need to make this end. You need to have the civilian casualties end. But if he had just started by publicly criticizing, I think that the belief, at least in the Biden administration, is that it might have been actually a moment for Prime Minister Netanyahu to stand up to the United States and say, we don't take our orders from the United States. Like, we have to do what's best in our security, and kind of use the disagreement with the U.S. as a political rallying cry for himself at home. And so I think this is one of the reasons why the Biden administration chose to, at least at the beginning, publicly support Israel.
But on the other hand, pressure is building in the U.S. Congress for Biden to do more to try to halt Israel's assault on Gaza. I mean, that pressure is coming from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and also increasingly from the center, where there's much more vocal criticism of civilian casualties. What does that criticism mean in terms of what President Biden can do?
Hopefully he can use it as leverage to get the Israelis to stop. You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu is an incredibly political creature who knows all about the importance of building his coalitions at home. And I think if Biden is able to talk to him on the phone and say, look, Bibi, I've given you space to do what you think you need to do to knock back Hamas, but political pressure is building at home. I can't keep doing this. And so I'm going to need to change my position if you don't stop this fighting soon. In many ways, it allows Biden to play a good cop, bad cop game with Congress right now. And I agree with you. I think that fundamentally the Democratic Party's approach to Israel has been shifting in recent years because the increasing view that Palestinian human rights and Palestinian voices need to be part of this equation, you know, and recognizing the humanity in Palestinians and all the terrible things that they are facing.
But doesn't Biden hedging things with Bibi, with Benjamin Netanyahu, doesn't that risk him looking bad to Arab allies and other people in the world, which could compromise him down the line on other issues?
Yes. I think especially, you know, we've had three efforts by the UN Security Council to put out a joint statement that the U.S. has blocked over the past week. And Biden, who came in making the case for multilateralism, in sharp contrast to Trump, this hurts in that space.
How come the Biden administration does not currently have a line to Hamas?
Hamas is designated as a terrorist organization under U.S. law. And therefore, legally, we are not allowed to have contact with them. Now, you know, in recent years, we have started, for example, to build relations or have secret negotiations with the Taliban. So you could see a world in which, you know, maybe over time something like this starts to happen. But for the moment, I'm not sure it's necessarily the most immediate or necessary thing that we need. It's not necessarily America's role by itself to play the mediator in this conflict. And there's a benefit to having others like the Egyptians, who control one of the key borders into and out of Gaza, who have a huge amount of influence with both Hamas and Israel, and actually are deeply engaged because of their own personal interest in stopping this fighting in their own neighborhood. So it doesn't seem to me necessarily that U.S. engaging with Hamas at this point is the most important thing towards ending this conflict.
Well, if the Biden administration is in talks with the countries that do have a relationship with Hamas, like Egypt and Qatar, what is the Biden administration telling the leaders of those countries?
Through the Egyptians, it's telling the Egyptians, do everything you can to get a ceasefire. We will be 100% behind you. With the Qataris, it's a little bit more complicated. The Qataris do have a relationship with Hamas. On the one hand, you know, they provide funding to Hamas and funding inside of Gaza. To some extent, the Israelis are okay with this and look the other way because it tends to keep things from totally blowing up. So I'm sure what the Biden administration is telling the Qataris is use your influence as best you can with Hamas to signal that we need an end to the current conflict. But also they're probably telling the Qataris not to get too involved and start to negotiate it themselves, because what makes this even more complicated is that the Qataris and the Egyptians really don't get along well at all and have a pretty intense rivalry. So you can have a scenario where the two of them are competing to be the central negotiator, which only ends up extending the conflict.
During the 2014 Gaza war, you were part of a small team of U.S. State Department officials reaching out to Israelis and Palestinians. What's different this time around?
The American envoy who's on the ground right now, Hadi Amer, was also part of that team 7 years ago when we were working on this together. And I think one of the big lessons, actually, that at least I took out of that experience, though, in 2014, frankly, is this lesson that at the end of the day, we, the United States, cannot by ourselves end a conflict between Israel and Hamas, precisely because we don't have a relationship with Hamas and don't really understand Gaza very well and aren't really there the way some of the other players are. And so, you know, there's an instinct in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the U.S. to roll in and bump everybody out of the way and say, we're in charge, we're going to solve this now. And that is just not the way to solve this conflict. And I think we did some of that in 2014. In that respect, I think the Biden administration has learned from the mistakes in 2014 and is trying to be much more careful and making clear, like, we have a significant role to play, but it's not just up to us. We have to work with the Egyptians. We have to work with the UN. We can't do this by ourselves.
Ilan Goldenberg directs the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. During the Obama administration, he served as chief of staff to the U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Thanks a lot, Ilan.
Thanks for having me.
As diplomats squabble, people on the ground are desperately hoping for international intervention, and humanitarian groups in Gaza are scrambling to keep up with the needs of families. Some 60 children have been killed in Gaza, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Hozaifa Yazji works with the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's in Gaza City now. I asked him, how do you begin to explain what the impact has been on children?
It's really an extremely intense situation at the moment. It's affecting everyone. And for sure, like, we are care about the kids the most at the moment. It's not easy situation for the adults. And you can imagine how much this is will affect the children. Especially the last 3 days, the bombardment has been intensified in Gaza City. And the sound, the heavy sound of the bombing, it's really scary and let the kids be in really shocked and trauma situations. personally, I have two kids, and to be honest with you, I'm struggling to deal with the situation. You know, like, you need to, as parents, to be strong, to not affect their psychology. And at the same time, we want to make sure that they are safe. But at the moment, there is no safe place in Gaza.
Huzaifa, how old are your children?
I have two boys, 7 and 4 years old.
And are they home with you, or where are they staying during the day?
Yes, they are all the day with me, home.
Families just must be incredibly stressed in Gaza. What are you advising Gazan parents to do to help their kids through this?
It's a good question, but it's not easy to answer. I can tell you that we don't know if we will wake up the next morning. But this is very important, to be strong, also to find justification. I'm trying to convince my kids that these are fireworks. It's not easy for them to believe that, but at least something to think about and to accept. I have lots of stories trying to read to them. Whenever we have electricity, 2 hours a day, 3 hours a day, I gave them my iPad to watch YouTube, some videos to distract them of what is happening.
You mentioned power outages on top of everything else. What's the prognosis for a return to electrical service?
The electricity infrastructure has been severely damaged. Moreover, Israel closing the commercial border with Gaza, and they don't allow fuel to enter to Gaza to run the power plant.
The issue of civilian casualties, Israel sends warnings to areas that they're about to target a building, and they tell people to evacuate. The idea is to avoid civilian casualties. Is there any evidence that civilians are being targeted?
In the last 3 days, if we look to the news and to the video footage that we have available, lots of households, civilian households, has been targeted without any warning. This has been increased in the last 3 days. Before I start talking with you, I have news about targeting several places, several households, civilian houses, without any warning. The last incident, it's a house in front of a hospital in the center of Gaza City just 1 hour ago. And there is a doctor has been injured because there is no warning, nothing happened, and there is already casualties and killed people in the place. So there is evidence. It's very obvious at the moment.
We've been talking about the effects of the missile strikes from Israel on children in Gaza, but I wonder what you are hearing from your colleagues on the Israeli side about the needs of children in areas hit by Hamas rockets.
Okay, so we have an office in Jerusalem. We have lots of colleagues there, and they are facing the same situation. We are in the same boat. So dealing with the kids is a problem, a struggle for all of us. And to be honest with you, this time, like, it's clear that the ones who are paying the bill are the civilians. So we urge everyone and all the international communities to push both the Israelis and the Palestinian military groups to respect the international laws in conducting hostilities. Civilians should be out of this situation.
Huzaifa, what will you say to your own kids tonight?
Last night, there was a heavy bombardment in my neighborhood. They are targeting streets, infrastructure. So you cannot move. So I stayed home, and to find a safe place, I slept with my kids in a small corridor between the rooms. There is no windows, there is no doors. It's considered a safe place. But to convince them that nothing has happened, it's not easy. So we start, myself and my wife, to tell stories to them, trying to play together in this 2 square meter space, spending the whole night with them. They slept and wake up many times because of the heavy bombardment. It's a mission impossible, but we are trying our best. I'm worried if this will last for longer because for sure this will leave a huge problem in the psychology of our kids and the new generation. It's a mission impossible, and we need to act immediately to stop this madness.
Huzaifa Yazji is the area manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's been telling us about the humanitarian conditions and the impact of the airstrikes on children in Gaza. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up later in the show, with hate crimes on the rise here in the U.S., there are new resources for how to report incidents.
Before booklets like this were released, there was no way for the seniors to really access this information.
And Chile is drafting a new constitution. New rules call for new authors.
They want new people writing the new constitution. That's what the Chilean people want.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Over the weekend, voters in Chile went to the polls to elect 155 citizens to rewrite the country's constitution. The results are quite startling. Voters favored independent and leftist candidates over those from the government's ruling center-right coalition. Chile's current constitution was drafted during the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, which lasted from 1973 to 1990. Julieta Suarez-Cao is a political science professor at the Catholic University of Chile in Santiago. Julieta Suarez-Cao, what did the results of the weekend election say to you about what Chileans want in their new constitution?
We can say for sure that what Chileans don't want is the same elite people that have been ruling the country, that used to be in government. They want new people writing the new constitution. That's what the Chilean people want.
Now, this process to have elected citizens write up the new constitution, it came out of the 2019 protests over inequality that rocked Chile. What happened then to make this election happen?
I could say it was over social inequality that is pretty important in Latin America in general. But still, it's not just inequality. It's inequality and this feeling that politicians, the elites, did not represent people's interests.
Who made the decision to have this election to create this more democratic approach to writing the Constitution? How did that come out of those 2019 protests?
We were almost 2 months in this violence and riot, and not only in Santiago, in the whole country. Political parties in Congress, the solution they came up with was, okay, let the citizenry decide. Let's call a referendum. Should we change the constitution? Yes, no. And in whose body will be in charge to do it? Congress or a constitutional convention elected just to write the constitution? It was a political party decision, but in a way, it was not a decision. It was a decision to be delegated to the citizenry.
When you look at the parties and affiliations of those who've just been elected to write up Chile's new constitution, what does it tell you about what's likely to be in that new constitution?
Wow, it tells me that they will have to build consensus. Because in a way, I think we can agree that there is some kind of a spirit of a more, I would call it like welfare state with more powers over the market. Chile is a very neoliberal country, and the marketplace is much more important than states in most parts of the country. So I would say they want a different state, a state that is closer to the people in terms of services, but also in terms of citizen participation.
It's interesting you say that because there are set-asides built into this process. There's going to be an equal number of men and women involved in writing up the new constitution. 17 people will represent indigenous groups in Chile. How significant is that?
The gender equity thing is significant worldwide. And for indigenous people, I think it's a landmark for Chile. Chile has a history of conflict with indigenous people, denying even in some cases important rights to indigenous people. So this is a historical recognition for indigenous people to be able to have a voice in the new Chilean constitution.
What's the timetable for getting this new constitution written, and who will need to approve it?
They have up to a whole year. They have to have a new constitutional text. But then there's going to be another referendum, and then the citizenry should say yes or no to the new constitution. So we are starting this process. We are not even in the middle of the process.
Julieta Suarez-Cao is a political science professor at the Catholic University of Chile in Santiago. Thanks a lot, Julieta.
Thank you, Carol. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Reports of hate targeting Asians in the U.S. have nearly doubled since March of 2020. That's according to new data from the forum Stop AAPI Hate. Advocates say the actual number of incidents is likely far higher because many incidents go unreported. One Korean American in California wants to change that. The World's Bianca Hillier has that story.
Esther Lim noticed the increase in anti-Asian rhetoric as soon as the coronavirus began to spread around the world.
COVID led to, you know, a stereotype that Asians are still barbaric, unclean, and a cause of disease.
This was bolstered, she feels, by President Trump's racist remarks about the virus.
Those were a direct threat to me. That's when I got really scared.
Lim lives in LA, just 15 minutes away from her parents. They immigrated from Seoul in the 80s. She worried about them and realized she wouldn't even know what to do if they were attacked. Lim hopped online and did her research.
I learned so much. I was like, oh my God, we do have a penal code for hate crimes in California. But I was like, wait, how come there isn't any of this information in my parents' native tongue?
Lim found that there weren't many resources in nearly any Asian language. So she decided to make her own. Lim created free booklets, aptly called How to Report a Hate Crime. In about 15 pages, readers learn what to do and who to call if they are a victim. It's now translated into 9 languages, including Thai, Vietnamese, Japanese, and Korean, and is mostly distributed to elderly Asians across the U.S.
Before booklets like this were released, there was no way for the seniors to really access this information.
Monica Lee is a Korean American who works for an organization called Korean Community Services in New York. She says the pandemic has highlighted the lack of language access for non-English speaking households.
Whether it's, you know, unemployment insurance or COVID-19 related health services or even the legal language around hate crimes, I think the language access piece is so important.
Lee says Lim's How to Report a Hate Crime booklets are really useful and badly needed. Asian Americans are the least likely of all ethnicities to feel very comfortable reporting hate crimes, according to a new survey from AAPI Data. Last week, Lee passed out hundreds of the booklets to senior citizens.
It definitely caught their eye because it's written in Korean.
Lee says many of the people she spoke with don't use social media or have smartphones.
We could be sharing this kind of information and raising awareness all we want via, you know, electronic methods and social media. But getting this information to them, the most vulnerable population in our community, is still quite a challenge. So it was really great to distribute a physical copy, a booklet that they could actually carry around in their pockets.
Creator Esther Lim has printed more than 60,000 booklets so far. $40,000 has poured into a GoFundMe page. Her parents are proud. And Monica Lee says Lim's readers are grateful.
One of the common things that they actually said was, thanks for not forgetting about us. And, you know, there's a word called 든든해 in Korean where it just feels like someone has your back. So I think just the fact that people like Esther and the young leaders in our community are really taking a stand for them, that helps them feel like they're not forgotten.
Printable versions of How to Report a Hate Crime are online at hatecrimebook.com. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. Ever say this? Those long hours at work are just killing me. Turns out they might be.
This is a major risk factor that we've never previously quantified, so we know now there is a concern.
Scientists can now tell just how bad it is for us when we burn the midnight oil. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. There's another area where the world is looking to the U.S. for leadership: the pandemic. And today, President Biden announced it would make additional vaccines available for other countries by the end of June. As The World's Alana Gordon reports, pressure is still mounting on the U.S. to do more.
Tedros Ghebreyesus, director of the World Health Organization, confided that he had mixed feelings a few days ago when he personally got vaccinated.
It was a bittersweet moment.
He said he felt gratitude for the hospital workers in Geneva that made that possible. But Ghebreyesus also could not shake the parallel distressing reality of that moment.
My thoughts were very much with the health workers around the world who have been fighting this pandemic for more than a year. The fact that so many are still not protected is a sad reflection on the gross distortion in access to vaccines across the globe.
Infections are spiraling out of control in places like India. And yet, in this race against the virus and its variants, only 0.03% of the world's vaccine supply is going to low-income countries. His calls for richer countries to do more to stop hoarding has become more desperate and urgent.
what the U.S. does and doesn't do, a lot of countries will take the cue here. So all eyes are on the U.S.
Jen Cates is director of global health and HIV policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She says the pressure is mounting for the U.S. to step up now. The U.S. has historically been the world's biggest funder of global health. President Joe Biden has said the U.S. would become an arsenal of vaccines for other countries. But last week, Democratic New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez asked this at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing.
My question is, who's coordinating the administration's international response?
Republican Senator Mitt Romney had questions, too.
Is there a written plan at this stage saying what our priorities are country by country?
In the hot seat was Gail Smith, the recently appointed coordinator of the global response at the U.S. State Department.
The first and most important thing we need is international coordination and leadership, and I believe the United States is able and willing to provide that. If you look at the fragmentation that characterized the first year of this pandemic, it quite frankly gave advantage to the virus.
Smith told senators that the U.S. is the largest donor to global vaccine efforts at $4 billion. It's working with Japan, Australia, and India to scale up manufacturing. The U.S. is also readying 60 million doses of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine to send out. That's in addition to billions in aid for other supplies and oxygen. And the country's on board with efforts to waive patents on vaccines. That all sounds great, but the details were too vague for Romney and others.
But at this stage, we're all here listening and frankly wondering, why can't we move as quickly as Russia and China to decide precisely what we want to do, where we want to do it, and communicate that to the world?
Outside Congress, leading global health experts like Dr. Krishna Udayakumar are urging more action, too. Udayakumar is a global health professor at Duke University. His team has found that the U.S. in the coming weeks will have hundreds of millions of excess doses of vaccines. Domestic demand is subsiding.
We are becoming complacent in places like the U.S., where it is becoming better. But our own health and our economy continues to be threatened because we are not effectively leading the rest of the world to respond to the pandemic everywhere else.
Today, Udayakumar joined other global health leaders in issuing a letter to the Biden administration, calling for more specific steps. Donated vaccines still need to be cleared for use. Dr. Mark Dybul is a global health professor at Georgetown and member of a global independent panel for pandemic preparedness. He says despite this growing impatience, the U.S. is on track.
I think we should give a lot of credit to this administration for acting very rapidly while they're fighting the pandemic here and doing quite a good job at that compared to where we were.
As the former head of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, Dybul has experience leading these kinds of efforts. He says the U.S. has stepped up response to the global AIDS crisis in the early 2000s, saved millions of lives.
It does take time to walk through all the stuff, plan for where you are.
Just this afternoon, President Biden made a big announcement about the U.S. role abroad. He appointed Jeff Zients to coordinate the global response, and he announced more vaccines for the rest of the world, an additional 20 million from the U.S. supply. Biden says the country has hit a turning point. A majority of adults have gotten at least one shot in the U.S. Infections have finally dropped in all 50 states.
Because we have done so much here, because of the power of American companies, research, and manufacturing, we can continue to do more to help the rest of the world.
To Krishna Udayakumar at Duke, these are good steps, but they're still small compared to the global need and the resources the U.S. has. In the coming days and weeks, global players are meeting at the G7 and G20 meetings and the World Health Assembly. How the U.S. shows up could make a big difference and define the future of the pandemic. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Here's the big question we were all asking this weekend. Do I still need to wear my mask? Late last week, the Centers for Disease Control issued new guidelines that fully vaccinated people can ditch their masks in most situations, both indoors and out. Actual policies are still set by state and local jurisdictions. Still, the CDC's guidance raised questions and concerns in a lot of communities, in particular among immigrant workers who make up a key part of front-facing industries like retail shops and restaurants. Pablo Alvarado is the co-executive director of NDLON, the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. I asked him what immigrant communities are telling him about the new mask guidance.
Well, it's very clear for people who worked in the meatpacking plants, very clear for people who work in restaurants, cooking meals, washing dishes, mopping floors, and cleaning toilets. When somebody takes their mask off, it's very clear that they're going to be further exposed to the virus. That's exactly what has been happening. So what it means is that they're going to get more sick and that more are going to die.
A lot has been mentioned during this pandemic about the vaccine inequities that exist for the Latino and immigrant worker communities. You're expressing real concern here that these new guidelines, which essentially allow people to take their masks off, that these new guidelines could put these communities' health and safety at further risk.
So I'm not an expert on how the virus has evolved or anything, but I do understand that it's been unjust and it has impacted, people of color, particularly Black and Brown workers, disproportionately. In the case of immigrants, undocumented immigrants, for example, for years the government has been discussing, and this is the kind of hypocrisy that really makes me indignated. The fact that they, at the same time that they call them essential workers, they continue to deport them. The only document that undocumented immigrant workers have gotten, for example, is came in the form of a death certificate when they stopped breathing. Right now, if they really want to help, undocumented workers, those who are keeping everybody working at home safely behind a screen or a telephone, give them a green card right now.
I want to get back to the issue of the new guidelines about the masks. In the communities of people that you're in touch with, the communities of essential workers, documented and undocumented, will they simply continue to wear their mask?
That's going to be our advice. We might want to make sure that we keep people safe because, we care about everybody, about employers, about people who come and dine in the restaurants where our people serve. We want to make sure that they continue to wear a mask. And we're going to, demand that employers provide the health and safety equipment that they need. And in the meatpacking plants, people were forced to work very close to their colleagues without the right protections. So the pandemic is not over. The virus is still out there, and workers need to be protected.
Pablo, as an immigrant from El Salvador and a former day laborer yourself, what's most on your mind when you think of the health right now of Latino and immigrant communities with this new guidance from the CDC?
I have lost close friends. I play in a band made up of day laborers. The saxophonist died. One of our organizers, Antonio Bernabe, passed. And I can go on telling you the many stories of people who have died, in the front lines of this pandemic. Gil Espinosa, a warehouse worker who died when he was 44. Alfredo Manriquez, like gardener, 54. A day labor organizer like Antonio Bernabe, Antonio Macias, 63, Enrique Garcia. These are real people who have perished because they were exposed to the virus in their workplaces. So of course, I'm indignated by the level of hypocrisy, the language that they use, but the practices that they have. And it doesn't matter whether it's the liberal government that we have or Trump. I think it's the same. The worker is always the one who pays the price. And particularly in this case, the undocumented worker.
Pablo Alvarado is the co-executive director of NDLON, the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. Thanks very much, Pablo.
Thank you.
Now to Brazil, a country that's struggled with the pandemic really since it began. Brazil has reported more than 15 million cases of COVID-19. Only the U.S. and India have more. For the 1 million Brazilians who work as family fishermen and women, it's been a particular struggle, one that's not letting up. As Michael Fox reports from southern Brazil, fishing communities there are now welcoming a very special time of the year with a ritual that could be dangerous.
From a small wooden shack at the top of the dunes, a few men keep watch over the half-moon bay of Pantanal do Sul on the southern tip of the island of Florianópolis. For this fishing community, it's the most exciting time of the year, the return of the tainha, or mullet. That's a large fish that spawned in brackish inland waters hundreds of miles south. They travel in huge schools that get close enough to the coast to be hauled into shore with massive nets. Right now, the fishers are watching the ocean and waiting for the fish's arrival in large enough numbers. When it's time, they'll send out WhatsApp messages, and the entire fishing village of Pantano do Sul will pour onto the beach. I used to live there, and I've seen it numerous times in years past. It's a big operation. The town's residents line the coast and heave on a giant net that's been dropped by boats rowing parallel to the shore. Dozens of men are knee-deep in the chilly water. They slowly drag in the net, and with it, hundreds of tainha. The fish are often well over a foot long, weighing 10 pounds or more. They flop on the sand, trying to escape back into the ocean. The fishers and villagers pick them up, two at a time, and carry them up the beach to be divided amongst themselves and anyone else who helped haul them in. One catch like this can sometimes round up thousands of fish. The entire community eats, says Amarildo Monteiro. He's a local fisherman, and he helps run Aranches, a family bar and restaurant, which is right on the beach. The whole community comes down to the beach to help pull in the net, and everyone gets fish. It's all of Pantano do Sul who eat the tainha from the communal catch, he says. It's a tradition that's been carried on for generations. Monteiro says, from the time of our grandparents, our ancestors, we use a boat with just one oar, and we are surviving. Despite the big motorized fishing boats, we're surviving. But COVID-19 can make this hard. Local regulations say the fishermen should be wearing masks and socially distancing. Monteiro says they follow all of the required safety protocols, but it's not always that easy. In this video of a communal catch last week on Gravata Beach, several miles north, roughly two dozen people haul in the net at close proximity. No one is wearing a mask. That's a concern, just as Brazil seems to be getting the pandemic under control. The virus has hit small-scale fishers up and down Brazil's coast hard. The island of Marinheiros, 400 miles south of Florianópolis, is at the mouth of Brazil's largest lagoon where the tainha are born and bred. Viviane Machado Alves is a fisherwoman there and a leader in the Brazilian movement of small-scale fishermen and women.
Então, assim, ó, tem localidades ali que, bem dizer, quase toda ela já foi infectada pela...
There are areas here where almost everyone has been infected by COVID-19, she says. There are no deaths, thank God, but a lot of cases. And the vaccination, like everywhere in Brazil, is very slow. She says their biggest issue lately is that they've been having a hard time selling their catch. It's shrimp season, but since there are no tourists, she says they've lost a lot of income. We have to sell to the middleman, she says. We have to sell to them at very low prices under the market rate. Last year, the government provided a substantial emergency monthly stipend for informal workers, including fishers. But it was cut and then brought back, but highly reduced. Cristiano Quaresma is a member of a group that has monitored the impact of coronavirus on fishing communities.
Essa redução tem feito os pescadores e as pescadoras.
He says that without this support, fishers have had to expose themselves more to the virus. In having to go out and sell the fish, they are exposed to the public, and this causes an increase in infections. Fishing communities in northeastern Brazil have had it particularly hard. On the edge of the small fishing village of Sirimbinha, Sildes Reis dos Santos pushes his boat out into the estuary. He and his wife are out crabbing most days of the week in a mangrove forest a short ride from their home.
Aqui até para remar tem uma técnica.
I met Reis dos Santos in late 2019 when I was reporting about the impact of a massive oil spill that covered Brazil's northeastern coastline for 1,000 miles. Out of fear of contamination, Brazilians there stopped buying fish and seafood. Small fishers like Reis dos Santos found it hard to stay afloat. This was just a few months before the pandemic.
Uns anos de difícil, né?
Difficult years, he says. We had some hard times. Stores closed. Here in Sirimbinha, we had some cases. The doctors say that 80% of the community had it. Tourism fell a lot. But we were able to sell some of our catch. Not a lot, but little by little. Cristiano Ramalho is a professor at the University of Pernambuco. He blames the government's lack of support for fishing families.
A chegada da pandemia, praticamente em um curto espaço de tempo ali, ela vai encontrar essa
comunidade. He says the arrival of the pandemic found these communities that were already suffering from a historic lack of public policies and the huge impact of the oil tragedy. Without a doubt, it made the coastal communities some of the most vulnerable for COVID-19 in Brazil. There are no easy answers. Financial hardships are likely to plague many communities for the months to come. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Southeast Asia had been one of the globe's success stories in containing the pandemic. Countries in China's backyard, such as Thailand and Vietnam, closed their borders quickly when the coronavirus first started to spread beyond Wuhan, China. And because of that, they had relatively few cases of COVID. To date, Thailand has recorded just over 600 deaths since this all began. Vietnam, only 37. But these success stories are at risk as officials in Southeast Asia struggle with a new spike. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins me now. Patrick, you're in Bangkok. What is the COVID-19 situation like in Thailand?
It's not so good, Carol. Thailand just saw its worst day for new infections, nearly 5,000 in one day. The virus is racing through prisons. It's racing through poor neighborhoods where people lived in more cramped spaces. And now the hospitals seem to be running out of beds. So the kind of horror stories that happened in America or Brazil last year, I think people are worried that that could come here. And we have to keep in mind, except for a few spikes, life has been kind of normal here. I mean, you can go to the gym, you can go to the pub. Everyone is very mask compliant, but now most public places are shut down. So Vietnam is also struggling with a spike too. And Vietnam was maybe the biggest success story in Asia when it comes to battling COVID. Cambodia, a much poorer country between Thailand and Vietnam, is also reeling. Laos as well. So it's been a major disappointment to everyone who thought, well, at least the Southeast Asian mainland countries had this under control.
What is behind this current spike?
Right. So just to focus on Thailand, there have been a few outbreaks here. The first was brought by Chinese tourists traveling from Wuhan in the very early days. The second centered around a fish market where migrants were working in close quarters. But both of those outbreaks got put down pretty quickly. This new wave, Carol, it really started exploding among government officials. It actually turns out a lot of them were going to this particular very pricey Bangkok nightclub. You could call it a gentleman's club if you want to be polite. And that was a hot spot. It started going from officials to high society, and then it got spread from there. Nightclubs are supposed to be closed, by the way, for more than a year in Thailand. So this notion among the public that officials were handling this really well, that notion has been severely damaged now that officials have become the news here for helping spread this virus.
Wow. What about vaccines? Are they coming anytime soon in Thailand?
Not fast enough. In Thailand, only about 1% of the population is vaccinated. Same with Vietnam. Both countries say they'll do a big vaccination drive starting in June, July. But, you know, delays are very possible because all around the world, these sort of middle tier countries have to wait for vaccines to become available once the Western countries get their fill. And Carol, the clock is really ticking. I mean, these Southeast Asian countries, their economies are just getting hammered. Shops are shut down. Hotels are shut down. No tourists can come. It's a real crisis, especially for Thailand. People are getting pretty desperate.
How are governments in Thailand and Vietnam responding to this?
It's not like France or Italy last year, where if you went outside your house, even for a walk, the police would tell you to go back inside. You can go outside, but not many stores are open. You can go buy groceries. You cannot sit down at a restaurant and have a meal. You cannot go to the gym. You can't even go to the park. And these rules kind of will change week by week as the situation changes, but it's kind of a light shutdown. And it appears that that will be in play for the foreseeable months because the percentage of people who have COVID-19 in Thailand and Vietnam is starting to get high enough so it looks like these shutdown measures won't just be able to tamp them down. And it probably will remain until there are vaccines.
Do you have any idea when these countries will open to the outside world?
Sort of. Both Vietnam and Thailand, they really want tourists who have been vaccinated to come soon to get the economy going, but they really can't do that until their own populations have some sort of herd immunity because vaccinated travelers can also come and potentially spread COVID. So this is actually hotly debated. You know, when do we let tourists back in? There were hopes that maybe in Thailand, at least, they could heavily vaccinate certain beach cities and open them up by the summer. This new spike makes that less likely. So now I think if all goes well, it's looking more like late 2021 for a big opening up for these mainland Southeast Asian countries. That's about how long it's going to take them to get enough of the population vaccinated that they can open up to tourists.
The World's Patrick Nguyen speaking to us from Bangkok. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, I keep telling my boss this, but now we know it's true. Working long hours is bad for your health. Not a huge surprise there. What is surprising, just how bad those long hours can be. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
More than 745,000. That's how many people died in 2016 of stroke or heart disease due to working more than 55 hours a week. So says a new study published today by the World Health Organization and the International Labor Organization.
This is a major risk factor that we've never previously quantified, so we know now there is a concern.
Frank Piga from the WHO led the study. He says working long hours can cause stress, which taxes the body, and it can lead people to drink, smoke, sleep worse, and eat unhealthy foods.
The key message here is that we need now to put in place laws and policies to limit the number of working hours that people can maximally work to address this concern.
Geographically, workers in Asia were the hardest hit by health burdens. Also at greater risk, men and workers middle-aged or older. Piga's team saw less of an issue in Europe. An EU directive there limits average work weeks to 48 hours.
Indeed, from the survey information that we have, people work at long hours at very low proportions compared to other regions. So we can see here where a policy is in place, the exposure is also low.
Piga says there's not strong evidence that working more than 40 hours but fewer than 55 hours a week increases health risks. Study co-author Tracy Woodruff says eating right, getting enough sleep, exercising, and reducing your stress through activities like meditation or yoga can all help improve your health.
And those, of course, are all really important and people should practice them. I think we just have to remember that it's important to do those and it's really hard to do them if you're working more than 55 hours per week.
Woodruff, who's a professor at the University of California, San Francisco's School of Medicine, says there's only so much an individual can do to deal with a systemic problem.
So that's why it has to be more of a partnership between the individual, the policymaker, and the businesses to pay attention to worker health.
Today's study found a big jump in less than two decades. Deaths from working long hours increased nearly 30% between the years 2000 and 2016. That's the last year the authors analyzed. The study doesn't cover the past year, but the WHO warns a shift to working from home and pandemic-era labor cuts may accelerate the trend of long workdays. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
With that, I'm punching out. Health comes first. The World comes to you each day from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Back with more tomorrow. From PRX.